accession number 10170, reel number 3.
Mr. Walter Spencer, Reel 3. We were talking about the events of September 27th, 1915. You moved into Luce. About what time of day would that be?
Approximately 2:30, I should think.
In the afternoon?
When we started out from Vermels to go into Luce, yes. There were a succession of old German communication trenches about 1/2 mile in advance of Vermels, and of course they were unoccupied and been very much damaged by shell fire. There were also a section of wire which had not been cut, and there were dead Highland Line and infantry still hanging on the wires.
Well, did this make you were all new troops? Did all this destruction and the signs of death, did that make a big impression of you? Were the battalion or your friends around you noticeably nervous about the prospect?
Yes, well, it did. We were all a bit, despondent when we saw what we did see, and we didn't realise that the war was so drastic, you know what I mean? In our young minds, it thought... And it was actually, they were the first dead troops we'd seen, you see.
Now, you went forward into Luce, and you say that you were using grenades to clear out some cellars. I just wanted to ask two questions about that. Had you had any training in the grenades?
Oh, yes,
and Mills
we bombs? Had that. We had that training, by the way, when we were at Blondec, when we first got into France. There was a bombing range there, and we used to go there and learn how to throw bombs.
What had that training consisted of?
Well, mostly they showed us how a Mills bomb was constructed for a start, how it's screwed in the end, you know, and where the firing tag was, as they called it, and also the lever and how it clipped back and how many seconds you had to hold it before you threw it, you see. if you held it while you counted 10, you never heard it go off. But if you let it go over 8, you did.
So you had to hold it for quite a while. It wasn't one of the 4-second fuses.
It was it was about an 8-second fuse. You could safely count up to 6. That's what we used to make 6. 6 was, well, you'd go about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, bang.
You threw it then on
yeah,
5.
But of course, often you'd throw them without, when you had 2 seconds, if it was an instantaneous thing, and if Jerry was near you, you see.
Were there any accidents or any problems about training when you were training with them?
No, they were very, very careful, and 9 times out of 10, they were not live bombs that we trained with, you see. Although the lever was on and the pin and all that kind of thing, you went through the whole motion and threw the bomb, but it was a dud.
Did you have confidence in the Mills bomb as a weapon at this stage?
Yes.
Were you confident in it?
Yes, especially in confined spaces. You see, my experience generally was this, that if you had to go down into a dugout and there were Germans there, they'd get you before you got them. But if instead of going down the dugout you threw the bomb, you'd know whether you were not involved and they were, you see.
Now, the other thing you mentioned was that you were engaged in... You were put straight into the Luce village and you were clearing out the cellars. Had you been trained at all in street fighting?
No, not actually in street fighting, but we knew what to do. We'd been lectured on it, street fighting, and...
What had they told you?
Well, they'd told us to always go forward very carefully and never to expose ourselves more than we could help, you see. You'd walk upside a wall for a start, or you'd get round the corner, you see, anywhere not to be seen.
What was the exact situation in Luce when you arrived? You were mopping up, I think you said.
Yes.
Had the front line, so to speak, gone beyond Luce, or was this the front line?
No, Luce was still occupied by German soldiers at the top end, but not the bottom end. And
what can you tell me exactly what happened as far as you were concerned to the battalion? How did you go about moving into the village?
Well, before our plan of campaign was this: there was a place there which was actually a colliery erection, a shaft, I suppose you'd call it, sticking up in the air. But they called that Tower Bridge, and we could see that I think a mile before we got to it, and that was the place we had to kind of march on. And when we got up to there, we halted then, and we were told that we split up into companies, like number one company will go to the left, and number two and three will go straight on, number four will go to the right, something like that, you see. And you took the various roads and went. And then you closed in again on the centre of the village and worked your way up the main street.
Do you remember the actual procedure you used at that early? Because this is very early stage of street fighting techniques. How exactly you proceeded up the village streets, do you remember?
Yes, we as far as possible, we extended order, what you call extended order, and, you know, about 4 or 5 yards between each man, going up the street. There were various streets, 3 or 4 streets, leading the same way we were going, and one lot would be clearing up the one lot, and the other be clearing the other, you see. And then we met, we're going to meet again at the top end, in front of Hill 70.
How had you been taught to use grenades? Because you said you used them to clear cellars. Was that your own idea, or was that how you'd been taught to do it?
No, actually, it was our own idea. You see, you could never bank on any circumstances that the enemy were doing. You see, they might be assembling in knots, or they might be extended, or down below, or anything like that. According to how you found the situation, you had to use your own brain the best way to attack.
Do you remember any incidents yourself, or what happened to you as you went through the village?
I remember this incident. Our Brigadier Haywood, he was in charge of the whole brigade. The brigade, of course, you know, would be a third of the division. And we were in the 3rd Guards Brigade. And Brigadier Haywood said to me, as we went up the main street, he said, "Where is your CO?" And I replied, "I believe he's been gassed, sir." He says, "Gas be buggered." That was the actual word he said. And that was all I saw of him. And he went on up the village then. But now, there's a supposition that we used gas at Lewes. But then they blamed the Germans for using gas. But the whole truth was that our artillery had fired gas shells the day before, the previous day, and the wind had changed and was blowing the vapour back toward the village of Lewes. That's what there was. There was a strong smell of gas in Lewes, but the gas was not being liberated by the other side at the time when we attacked.
Which sort of smell did it have? Which gas was it? Can you remember?
Chlorine. C-H-L-O-R-I-N-E. I was an anti-gas instructor, so I know a bit about this business.
How did this mild mixture of chlorine affect you as you were working in the village?
For a start, you couldn't liberate chlorine to be effectual unless the wind was between 5 and 12 miles an hour. If there was a higher wind than that, it dispersed the gas rapidly, and if there was lower, the gas wouldn't travel. And chlorine, the effect of chlorine on the human body, of course, you breathe it up and then you got it down in your lungs and it made a swelling and caused what the oedema or fluid of the lungs. And that would very soon be fatal.
Now, how much gas was there actually in the village while you were there? Was it enough to cause many symptoms or just...
Not really, no. I don't think we had... I'm not quite sure that we had any actual gas casualties at all. There were some affected by the gas, and they did put the gas helmets on. It was up to them, you see, if they smelt it, to immediately put the helmet on.
Which helmet were you using?
The old shirt helmet.
Can you tell me how that worked?
Well, the old shirt helmet was actually a hood of cloth with artificial lenses into to see through, and it also had what they call a nose clip on, so that you couldn't breathe through your nose, and all the breath that you breathed had to come through the tube, which went into your mouth.
How effective was it?
Not very effective, I'm sorry to say, because there was very little chemical in there which would minimise the gas.
Now, you weren't an anti-gas instructor at the time, I presume, not in 1915, were you?
Oh, no. No, that's later.
No, that's fine. That was clear enough. Now, did you actually have to put your helmet on as you worked?
No, I didn't. No. No, it wasn't sufficient. Wasn't sufficient gas about.
Do you remember anything
else? You could certainly smell it, but it wasn't sufficient to cause any trouble.
Do you remember anything else about what happened in the village?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you that we proceeded through the village, and as I say, we did drop a few Mills bombs in to make sure that these dugouts had been cleared. You see, when you found a cellar of a house, it was always, as I say, best just to drop one in, even if there were nobody there. You carried on out the way.
How many did you carry? How many Mills bombs did you carry each?
Well, it depended upon what kind of attack you're going to make. But generally, we'd have three Mills bombs.
And you had that the next day?
Yes, you'd have a bomb bag here, you see.
Is it, from what you say, it sounds as if the Germans didn't contest the village too much, that they were there, but they fell back as you advanced. Would that be accurate?
That's right, yes. The majority of them did fall back. Some were took a few prisoners and killed a few, but not many. Majority of them retired up Hill 70. There was a slope at the end of the village which started Hill 70, and over the other side of Hill 70 was the town of Lens, and Lens was their chief objective at the time.
Did you see any of the Germans yourself during this advance?
Yes. Getting toward night time, 8 o'clock at night, it was dark, and we were actually laying just above the village and almost into some old German dugouts, German communication trenches, I should say. And I laid out there in the open, and Jerry was firing these very lights to see who was moving about. And if he saw anybody moving about, he got a machine gun and he'd turn it on them, you see. One of these very lights came straight down on my back, and I had a haversack on my back, and it burned a hole straight through the haversack. And I didn't move in case Jerry put his machine gun on me. But fortunately, it burnt out, or else I couldn't have done much about it.
had the battalion suffered many casualties at this stage?
Yes, but of course we didn't know. But at the time, I would say, I know from facts now that I would say we'd easily suffered 150 or 200 casualties.
At that stage?
Yes, at that stage, while we were in the village.
But you hadn't been particularly aware of it at the time?
No, that's right. No, because you scattered quite a lot, you see. It was only when you got later on, when we got up and we actually did get into one of his reserve lines on Hill 70, but that was about halfway up the hill.
Okay, who was in when you were in action? Who decided what you were to do? Did you find it was the officers, your second lieutenants, told you what to do, your NCOs, or did you decide on your own? This is in action. Who was the one who decided?
It depended how collected you were. If you were in a big collection, there'd be perhaps almost a company. Then the captain of the company would be in charge. But otherwise, it was generally the second lieutenant, who was a platoon officer in charge of 60 men, he would give all the orders to the NCOs, and the NCOs, see, they were carried out, you see, among the men.
So, as far as you were concerned, in this, your first experience of action, it was the officers who were the mainstay of the command structure.
That's right, yes.
The NCOs just carried out their orders.
That's right.
Could you give me an account of the night action on Hill 70, then, as it flowed on from there?
Yes, after the very light affair, we laid out there, I should think, from 2 to 3 hours afterwards, and when it was completely dark. And then we made a rush for what was had been a German communication trench, and we got entrenched in there and tried to dig in a bit deeper. It was only about 2 foot, 2 foot 6 deep, and we trying to get as far down as we get as much cover as we could. But we didn't succeed in getting far, but we remained in that position all the next day, and Jerry did not counterattack, but the next night he started to counterattack, and we realised that the position was hopeless, and we had to retire. We were relieved, by the way, by a battalion of the Middlesex Regiment.
When you went forward in the attack, were you under a lot of fire?
Yes, the machine gun fire was very intense, but there was no artillery fire because we were on a hill, you see, and he couldn't get his shells to drop just where he wanted them.
How did you react? This is the first time, again, you've been under heavy fire. How did you cope with it yourself?
Well, fairly well. You could hear your bullets whistling by, as you might say, but as long as they didn't hit you, you were all right. And you kept your heads well down, that's the main thing, and you got as much protection as we could from this disused trench. But we found it was not tenable in daylight not to move about in, you see. We just had to lay there, and it was an awful, awful position to be in, to lay for hours and hours and not be able to move, because his machine gun fire dominated the position that we were in. He had so many machine guns on it, and everything and everybody moved, they were fired at them.
How deep was this old communications trench?
This trench, well, I would think after we'd made it a bit deeper, it'd be about a yard deep, from a yard to 4 foot, we'll say, in places.
So it was more a sketch of a communications trench originally. It hadn't
That's
actually
right.
been dug.
Yes, but it was some protection, you see, so long as you made use of the whole amount of ground that you could. But you hadn't got to bob your heads up or anything like that.
Did you find the entrenching tools suitable for the task of that
well,
sort of digging?
Actually, to be truthful, they were not very much good, except when you got into sandy soil or somewhere like that. But even in clay, it was a job to dig far with an entrenching tool. It'd take you double of the time to dig a 5 foot trench with an entrenching tool.
Were you, during the attack and then later on in the trench, were you suffering more casualties? Were the battalion suffering heavily?
I think our heaviest casualties were just as we were moving up to Hill 70 from the village, which was a matter of perhaps 100, 150 yards from where the where the rise started above the village. And that's when the machine gunners were mowing us down. Literally, you could see men dropping, and all you could hope to you weren't going to be the next.
The German counterattack, did you actually see them attack? What can you remember of the attack?
We saw them replenishing their supplies in the trenches, you see. You see them come over the top and drop into their new front line, you see. They'd had to make a new front line because they'd been driven out of Lewes, you see. But they seemed to do that about the same time that we were trying to consolidate their position in the reserve trench.
Did they actually counterattack, or did you just withdraw because the position was untenable?
Well, they reinforced their front line trench preparatory to an attack, and they didn't actually make the attack while we were there, but the Middlesex got it after us the next night.
So you didn't actually abandon the position, you just were relieved by the Middlesex?
That's right, yes. Yes.
After being relieved, you fell back to La Bourse,
That's right,
again.
Yes.
What was the morale of the battalion like? I mean, it was your first action, you'd taken
yes.
heavy casualties.
Yes.
What was the mood of yourself and the men?
The morale was not very good, and, well, generally speaking, everybody had lost one of their pals or friends, you know, in the attack, and would not return, so you kind of wrote them off and say they'd gone. And wanted a bit of cheering up. And I think I told you that when we got back there, a Captain Morrison, who was in charge of the... Captain Morrison, who was in charge of the battalion then, because the CO had been removed to a casualty station, he got the general service wagons to go to a brewery, and they brought two big barrels of beer, and they... Then they went out and got two loads of logs, and they lit a huge bonfire in the school playground where we were billeted, and we all got round and started singing songs and drinking the beer, just to liven us up a little bit.
That sounds like it was reasonably effective from the way you tell it.
Yes. He was a very fine man, was Captain Morrison. He had plenty of money, and I believe, I never knew the going of him, but I believe he was killed soon afterwards.
Were you reinforced before you went back into the line at Hullock around about the 3rd of October, according to your notes?
No, we weren't, actually, because reinforcements were slow coming up from the base, and the base was a long way away, and there wasn't much transport available while attacks were on, and so we had to go in as we were. I would say it would be scarcely half the battalion who went in at Hullock. Now, Hullock was a lovely place because there was beautiful white chalk trenches there, and we were quite safe at Hullock, and it was a real rest from what we'd been in at Lewes.
Was there no activity in on the front?
No, it was fairly quiet because we got some Bavarians in front of us, and wherever the Bavarians were, it's a fairly peaceful part of the line. You see, we had to vary our positions as the Guards Division as to where the Prussian Guards were, and if we knew they were in a particular sector, they moved us there. But and I think it was vice versa. If Jerry knew that we were there, the Guards Brigade were anywhere in the vicinity, he'd move these posh troops of his to counteract us, you see. But if you got in the line with the Württembergers or the Bavarians or anybody like that of the German army, it was comparatively a soft and safe front. You could just carry on with the ordinary trench lookout, as you might say, and not much firing done.
I'll come to more about raiding and various other trench activities like sniping and such. But it sounds as if you did find the Bavarians or Württembergers in front of them, you were prepared to live and let live.
Yes, that's true. Yes, and the conditions we were on then, and being weak in strength, we wouldn't have made an attack until we got another draft up to make the battalion up to 1,000 men.
What could you describe the trench system at Hullock, you know, how it was organised, the communication?
Yes, they were exceptionally deep trenches, and they'd be, I should think, easily 5 foot 6 deep, and then they were what we call riveted with sandbags, you see, which made them actually deeper or more preventative to firing. All round Hullock for, I think, 2 or 3 miles was pure chalk, just like being on the South Downs, and we really rejoiced in that.
Did the trenches have things like fire steps?
Yes, they had fire steps because some of the regiments weren't quite as tall as the Guards, you see, and some of these bantams couldn't see over the top otherwise.
What about any form of dugout in the chalks?
Yes, they even had dugouts in the chalk, but they weren't too deep because they needn't be because the ground above was reinforced, you might say.
Would the dugouts be more of the cubby hole variety, or were they actually properly dug out?
Well, they were properly dug out because see, there would be so many. If you were occupying a trench, there'd be so many of the signalers and all those kind of people there. And wiring men and people who went up and did jobs over the top when they could, and they were available at the dugout.
How long were you in the line at Hullock? I don't suppose you remembered.
I don't really remember, not to be correct.
Do you remember going to the Ammaquin slag heap? That's the next thing in your notes.
Going
to the Ammaquin slag heap. I don't know it myself. It's the next thing in your notes of what your movements.
The Queen. On the, I don't quite get the word you say after on the Queen. Yeah. Yes.
And where was that?
That was just on the left of the trenches as we went through. It was where the mine workings were, of course. That's what caused the stack heap. They'd brought the coal up from down below.
And that was a similar sort of sector. So you were in this sector until you went to the Levante.
That's right. We went back to Levante then. Yes. Which was slightly further 2 hour left at that time, Levante was. But Levante was a fairly peaceful spot. And
what were the trenches like there?
The trenches were pretty good there, but not so chalky as they were at Hullock. We just got out of the chalk seam, but they were a lighter land. They weren't clay even. Most of the trenches around the Ypres salient were clay. You see, we hadn't it on the clay at Levante. Levante was a really nice little town, and it was also occupied by French civilians because they were a little bit further back behind the line.
And where were you when you were in the line?
When we were in the line, we'd still go up just to the left of Hullock, of where we'd come out. They'd call it another sector further up, you see.
But you don't remember any particular place?
No, because there was no village or anything like it. It was barren land, like farmland, wasteland.
And this also was a quiet sector?
Oh, yes, yes.
Now, you were in this area from late 1915 right into 1916.
Yes.
And then you were moved to the Ypres area.
Yes.
Essentially.
Yes.
What was the first impression of that? Because of your first move into the Ypres area, did it have a reputation?
No. It was what we call a medium part of the line. It wasn't really too busy or too slack, you might say. It was just a bit of casual firing among each side there. You see, the general idea, if you were not making an attack, was just to keep things quiet and make sure there were no trench raids or anything like that. Because the great thing that the Germans tried to do, and we tried to do, of course, was to know who was in front of you, who you were opposing. And then you acted accordingly. If you knew that the troops were fairly decent, you got a Württemberger, a poor old Landstürmer, a very old man, you wouldn't bother too much about it, and there wouldn't be much firing, or heavy firing. There'd be a little bit, but not much.
Right. So, when you did move to Ypres in 1916, into the sector, into the salient, you were based, I think, at Poppering mainly, you said.
That's right, yes.
Popperings, whereabouts were you in the line? This is in 1916, not 1917.
Yes, well, we'd be in the salient. We'd get back to the salient again, Ypres salient.
And whereabouts in Ypres salient?
We'd be in front of the Menin Gate, I think, in 16. Not so far up as Hulthurst was on our right, and so was Passchendaele. Messines was on it. Messines on the right-hand side, that's right. Messines Ridge was just along on our right in the next position we were up there. That was earlier on, of course.
What I want to do now, really, is because I know you're a little vague about where you were at a specific time in the Ypres salient, but you were there, according to the notes you gave me from a diary you took, for a good part of 1916.
So yes.
I'd like to ask you questions about trench life generally, just relating to the Ypres salient in 1916.
No, it's just so.
What sort of trenches were there in the Ypres salient?
Trenches were good. They're about the best trenches there were in the salient. And it wasn't a bad position as far as danger was concerned. We could get a decent night's sleep and all that kind of thing, but you couldn't in some positions. You could get very little sleep. And you see, another point is this, that if you got in good position, you'd probably stay in the line a day or two longer than you did in the others, because the others were, the fronts were fluctuating so much. You'd perhaps go in for 3 days, you see, into a what we call a bad front, and then out for 4 or 5 days in reserve, and then back again, you see.
But all in the Ypres salient, somewhere in different parts of the Ypres salient.
That's right, yes, yes.
What was it like in the front line when you were? Were you put in the front line, or were you always kept in reserve?
Yes, we were in the front line and in the reserve in the salient because, of course, Poppering was what we call the second reserve because that was rolled back. That was a place of refuge, as you might say. But the other place was usually within, we'll say, a quarter of a mile of the actual firing line.